Dance, baby, dance, come and dance with me. Hear the beat of the pounding sea. Ride, baby, ride, come and ride with me. Let your feet go easy and free.
What do you make of this?
Where does the other end go?
It dumps into the ocean.
It looks exactly like the South American Fantigua fish. I hope you can take one alive, Sheriff.
I still believe that a human clawed that girl to death.
The Beach Girls and the Monster. Starring John Hall, Sue Casey, and the glamorous Watusi dancing girls from Hollywood's famed Whiskey A Go-Go nightclub. Music by Frank Sinatra Jr.
You got a monster in the turf.
Jinx, do you have a problem? You won't have after you meet the monster on the beach. If you see this ghoul, play it cool. Beauties in bikinis, laughing, singing, surfing, sinning. Beach party lovers making hey hey in the moonlight while the monster waits and watches. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This one will kill you.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And if you've been listening to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, you know that those dulcet tones belong to my partner in crime, Michael Price, who, along with Joey Hambrick, our producer, bring you the Forgotten Horrors every month. And we should say, we did hear from some people on... Where do we hear from people, Joey? Joey knows all of it.
They gave us stars on iTunes.
On iTunes, yeah. That they were hoping we could do it regularly, and now we are doing our best to do it every month. If Joey would quit having children, we could probably hit that. Actually, you've had your first child. Charlie was born a couple of months ago, and that's why we've jumped 1 month. But, Michael, tonight, or today, or whenever... people happen to be listening to this, we're talking about a film from 1965 called Beach Girls and the Monster, with a once major studio star in the lead role, a man named John Hall, who a lot of baby boomers remember also as Raymar of the Jungle.
Universal Pictures was never like this.
That's right. That's exactly right. And who did Raymar? Was that Nassur, or am I getting it mixed up with Sheena? I may be getting that mixed up with Sheena, Queen of the Jungle.
Nassur had a hand in a lot of early day TV. I hadn't thought about Raymar of the Jungle in a long time.
Well, any character that has a TV character that's his own Charlton comic, which I believe Raymar had.
I believe that's
a Charlton comic. But John Hall, by that time, actually probably had a little bit better budget on Beach Girls and the Monster, would be my guess. And did he not?
Let's get the camera and go out to the wooded area and pretend that it's a jungle.
Right. Did he not have the film equipment, the camera, and things that did John Hall not own those? Is that one of the reasons that that Beach Girls and the Monster was made?
He took his filmmaking very seriously. So seriously that very few other people need to take him at all.
Right.
But Beach Girls and the Monster is practically a home movie. I think John was coming off the influence of an earlier Universal Pictures star named Ken Maynard,
mm-hmm.
who owned his own production outfit, produced his own Universal Westerns, often over the objection of the studio chiefs, and in fact shot a lot of the stuff with his own privately owned Bell and Hall equipment.
Ken Maynard did this.
Ken Maynard did that. He also wrote a lot of his own music. He wrote his own scenarios. He had friends direct.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ken's star was in decline, just as John Hall's was rising, originally through an Edgar Rice Burroughs picture called The Lion Man,
mm-hmm.
not at Universal. And so the action hero to beat in the late 30s, mid to late 30s, or even earlier, was Ken Maynard.
Mm-hmm.
Very much a do-it-yourself filmmaker who happened to, you know, he wasn't much of an actor, but boy, could he ever ride and stunt, and he was a real cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the next semi-generation of action heroes, especially those who wound up at Universal like John Hall, of course they accepted Ken Maynard as a model.
Oh, I see. So you're basically drawing a direct line between Ken Maynard's utilization of his own equipment and John Hall's generation later or so.
That's exactly the case. And you know, not that Hall had major league backing by the time
right.
he made Beach Girls and the Monster, but the he brought a big league attitude to the project.
He did.
Even if the resources were lacking.
Right, yeah. I would say that you're right. He did, and he also also seemed to take the acting in it very seriously. I mean, he mm-hmm. is the lead character, even though, without giving it away, in case there's someone listening to our voices on the planet who hasn't seen the picture, he even though his character is flawed, he really kind of brings a little bit of old Hollywood to this picture.
Oh, yeah, and... And he was good at playing conflicted characters. If you remember The Invisible Man's Revenge, for example.
Oh, of course, yeah.
The title character, John Hall, ooh, this guy is not a hero. He might have some good in him, but he's doing his best to keep it hid.
Right, right. That's true. I never had thought about that, but that's you look back, that's an antecedent to his performance in Beach Girls and the Monster.
Yes, exactly. Very conflicted. And... Just an amazing career he had, and how he went down swinging.
He did go down swinging, and let's talk a little bit about where this comes in the, and I always get this word wrong.
Pantheon.
Thank you. Of beach movies,
and it's
toward the end, and you know when a film trend, gets toward the end or starts dipping in box office. It's our theory that we've espoused, I think, on this podcast before, of just add monsters.
Oh, yeah. Well, even American International, the Wellhead just added monsters.
Sure, in Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, they were throwing in their contracted horror stars from the beginning of the Beach Party
right.
series.
Right.
But sooner or later, yes, the monstrous aspect becomes the point of the whole show, and it's like, yeah, they're trying a little too hard to revive this failing subgenre.
Right. And
but,
you know,
so what? It validates our theory.
It does validate our theory, just like the Abbott and Costello movies do.
Mm-hmm.
And many others along the same lines when there's the motorcycle movies, when you end up with werewolves on wheels, right? I mean,
Bowery Boys, my goodness, what franchise doesn't get up? You know, Jiggs and Maggie
right.
ended up with a ghost story.
That's true. That's true. That most of the franchises end up with some sort of ghost or monster or murder mystery or some sort of thing, mm-hmm. especially the B pictures in the 40s and 50s. And now we've got two, actually, that sort of put a nail in the coffin of the Beach Party pictures with this and with... Del Tenney's Horror Party Beach, that was actually mm-hmm. shot, what, around Pittsburgh, I guess, wasn't it?
And that was much earlier in the cycle,
right.
but it still fits the model.
It does. And in addition to John Hall, who a lot of people will remember from his films with Maria Montez, as you say, with Universal Pictures back in the, mm-hmm. the golden days of Hollywood, the other big name that people will recognize is Frank Sinatra Jr., who did the music. Now, he was not a big name at that time, and I remember, matter of fact, we'll be dealing with this more. I don't want to give away the whole farm because we deal with this in our upcoming book that we're doing on this on the surf movies. But Frank Sinatra Jr. apparently was a family friend, and he of the people who produced the picture, and he got to he needed the work, and they contracted him to do the music, which ends up being, or begins the film, I should say, with a song called Surfin' Baby and four dancing girls on the beach, which doesn't have a whole lot to do with what's going on. But then again, they keep going back to scenes that are sort of non sequiturs throughout this whole picture. There's a, for instance, did that beach scene with the couple of kids and the surfers strike you as a kind of a From Here to Eternity knockoff early in the picture?
Well, it's easy to imitate and call it a homage.
Exactly.
That's not the first time that particular composition has been used, visual composition.
And it won't be the last, probably.
Oh, no, mm-hmm. no. It's always recognizable and always gets a, you know, assuming anybody sees the picture. This picture didn't get that widely seen.
No, it was USA Films or somebody, I believe USA Films or US Films, I believe it was the name of the distributor.
And, it had a parent company called American Academy, mm-hmm. and then had basically low rent distributors.
Mm-hmm. Was it the same group that distributed Hall's other film, The Side Hackers, that we wrote about in Big Book of Biker Flicks?
That sounds right.
I don't have that reference right in front of me. But the biggest non-sequitur in the whole picture, and let's just give a very quick synopsis. A girl gets killed on the beach by an apparent monster, and John Hall, who is an ichthyologist or a biologist or something, I don't know what he is, mm-hmm. but he's somebody who should know, thinks it's some sort of mutated creature, and then people start dying off on the beach. Meanwhile, he's got the queen of all slutty wives on board, who's always after him because he's spending too much time in the laboratory. And then they've got his son and a friend who was apparently crippled in an auto accident that Mark had something to do with, right? I'm sorry, that not Mark, but for Rich had something to do with. Mark is
that
the,
would
is
be
the cripple
right,
guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the cripple guy is played by Walker Edmondson, and the interesting thing about him is there's that, and I get to the non sequitur scene now, the scene on the beach where they've got the hand puppet, the lion hand puppet, and they're doing the song, after these grisly deaths have multiplied on the beach, they have a little weenie roast or something out there, and they do a song, Walker Edmondson, although he is disguised in a big beard and a long wig, so you can't tell it's the same guy that's playing the tortured cripple person in the picture.
Right.
And Janie, who is the girlfriend of Rich, the son, do a song called "There's a Monster in the Surf."
Oh yeah.
And they're all clapping and carrying on, having a big time, and I guess they just don't really connect the fact that this might be in poor taste, considering they haven't even put those poor bikini girls in the ground yet, probably, from the monster attacks. But the tone of this picture is really something, because they keep trying to do the same thing that they do in the AIP pictures, which is have a lot of levity going on, and it just makes for a really weird and uneven tone in the whole thing.
Well, that's what happens when you let the amateurs play on the big kids field.
And who are the amateurs that you're seeing in this picture, Michael?
the people who made it, mm-hmm. not necessarily John Hall so yes, much, but, of course not. The backers, the composers of the story, and that's what's her name, Joan Gardner, mm-hmm. original story. She was basically a musician.
Right. I wonder if she had something to do with There's a Monster in the Surf.
Well, her background was in rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the opportunity to exploit Walker Edmiston's very versatile vocal talents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he was no Dawes Butler, but he had a very had a very resonant and adaptable voice. You know, I mean, he was in film for a long, long stretch.
Yes, he was.
And eccentric voices. Well, he did that creepy Zuni fetish doll in a TV movie called Trilogy of Terror.
Oh, the one that attacks Karen Black.
Right.
Oh, I didn't know that he did that.
It sounds like the voice in Trilogy of Terror sounds like an electronic effect. It's not.
It's Walker Edmiston.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I had no idea. And didn't he play in some other like sort of teen things as well?
I would have to look up his filmography. Right. Never really an actor of particular interest.
Mostly a voice actor, then.
Oh yeah, once mm-hmm. in a while you run across. Once in a while you run across a performance so weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and yes, he does have. Does have a lot of children's TV.
Children's TV, okay.
Worked for Disney, worked for, mm-hmm. oh gosh, worked for network kid shows, worked for the Ross Bagdasarian interests mm-hmm. on Alvin mm-hmm. and the Chipmunks, what mm-hmm. have you.
Okay. Well, one actor that I think does really deserve a little closer look is Sue Casey. She just abs. I mean, I realize it's a scenery chewing kind of role, but as this just slatternly wife of John Hall's character, she's really good.
She never would have. She never would have got that chance at a bigger studio. Although she kept fairly busy.
She kept busy for decades with mm-hmm. tiny parts or with extra work, or you know, she's in some very big pictures and some little tiny roles. And right at this particular point, this film came out in 65, and at this particular point, she made two films back-to-back that showed what she could do. This one, and again, there is a little bit of, I think there's a little bit of scenery chewing going on there, but she just really bites into that part as that, as that just terrible woman. And then she goes right from that to a film called Swamp Country. Baker Knight, who is a fascinating character, is really his only real picture, and he's all over it. Rex Allen's in it, and different. But in this, she goes from being like a slatternly wife to like a slatternly mom in Swamp mm-hmm. Country. She's got a couple of daughters, and she is great. She was really, really a good actress, and. And in these particular kinds of roles.
Yeah, well, you could tell she'd been, I think it's fairly obvious, she'd been watching Shirley Booth.
Good point. It's also fairly obvious she's been on a ton of sets, too. She knew her way around movies.
Oh, yeah.
She
yeah,
wasn't intimidated by the movies. And, when you know, in these kinds of pictures, a lot of times you get people that do have a little bit of the deer in the headlights looking. She just was, both this and Swamp Country, and I would recommend Swamp Country, which is almost a forgotten horrors picture, almost worthy of being called a horror movie. It's not, but it's a pretty strange picture, and she's really good in it. And again, she played all of these parts, and she played dozens and dozens of roles, sometimes uncredited, but she just hung in there for a long time. I think she's one of those people who probably knew that she had talent and kept hoping to break through, but all she really got as far as leads go were Beach Girls and the Monster and Swamp Country.
Oh, yeah.
And, boy, in both of those, I think she steals the show. I think she steals the show from John Hall, who's a pretty accomplished, you know, certainly by miles the most accomplished actor in the cast.
Probably he was glad to be running a project, even, you know, even though the resources were lacking. Sue Casey seems not to have asked herself, what am I doing here?
Right.
It was, I'm sure some of the lesser players felt they were paying some dues, but it's not easily dismissed as a throwaway film.
No, what would you say are the strength of the particular strengths of the picture then?
Well, you've got your conflicted leading role.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your willingness to basically turn the genre kind of inside out. To keep certain elements that will make it recognizable as an imitation beach party picture,
mm-hmm.
and yet to throw in some ferocity that never would have occurred to American International.
Which you sometimes find in those lower budgeted films. We found that in any number of the pictures we've talked about here on the Forgotten Horrors podcast, from Rat Fink to many of them. What was the Peeping Tom film that we watched?
You mean Private Property?
Private Property, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they seem to, when you see a film that is as low budget as those, and they did make AIP look like MGM by comparison, you see those and you really enter a universe where subliminally, and I remember this when I was a kid going to the theater, because I was in a small town, Chelsea, Oklahoma, and they booked the cheapest films they could get on the weekends. And you see some of the film group stuff as opposed to AIP, or you saw some of the stuff like U.S. films, like Beach Girls and the Monster, and you realized this was not quite as safe as the stuff that you were seeing from the other studios.
Oh, no.
Anything could have Halco International. We saw a ton of Halco stuff when
mm-hmm.
I was a kid. Same thing. They had to maybe up the exploitation ante a little bit, and maybe you just sort of subconsciously knew that. But in something like Beach Girls and the Monsters, I mean, there's I'm not going to say gore, but there's certainly violence in that you wouldn't have seen even in an AIP film. And AIP was not, you know, it was MGM, but you wouldn't have seen it in an AIP picture of that time.
Right.
And so, you know, so with Beach Girls and the Monster, you're never quite sure how far they're going to go. Maybe that's how I should have said it.
Now, probably a precursor of what Roger Corman did when he moved from AIP over to New World.
Mm-hmm. Or what he did with Film Group. I mean, you look at something like A Beast from the Haunted Cave. And it doesn't look, it's a lot, or Beast from the Haunted Cave is probably the best. I was thinking of Ski Troop Attack and some of those, but Beast from the Haunted Cave.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Beast from Haunted Cave is a dangerous movie.
It is a very dangerous movie, and even you look at Little Shop of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. They're different from what AIP is. As radical as AIP stuff was, as much as we loved those AIP monsters, I mean, this stuff was different. It could be better, it could be worse. I remember seeing a Halco International film, and help me out, Michael, I think it was Anne Gwynn, maybe it was like her last picture. And
you mean that Meteor Monster?
Meteor Monsters, exactly.
Or also known as Teenage Monster.
Mm-hmm, Teenage Monster or Meteor Monster. That was a Halco picture.
And that was a Halco.
It was horrible. But it had nothing, but you just never knew when you went in. That's why you love to see the off-brand. When I was a kid, 11, 12, 13 years old, you love to see the off-brand pictures come into town, because you never quite, it was just a little bit more of a dangerous walk with those pictures.
Uh-huh, that's right.
And certainly with this picture as well. And I think, you know, it's kind of found a new life on DVD. I don't know that there's that many people left in the world who haven't seen it, but it's certainly worth a look.
Well, yeah.
And then some, I think, but if nothing else, but to see John Hall and to see really Sue Casey, because she is just, I was just kind of blown away by what she did with it. And this is a film also, as we segue into our projects that we are covering in our upcoming book.
Fantasies in the Sand.
Fantasies in the Sand. And we're going through it. But what about, would you suspect we're about halfway through that by now?
I would say once these last two chapters get laid in, mm-hmm. and I've already started indexing them, and the book is laid out through about, it passed page 100.
Oh, good.
Won't be a big old thick book, but mm-hmm. it won't be a little skinny book either. Mm-hmm. And the historical perspective on the Beach Party movies, I won't say we're as comprehensive as Hollywood surf and beach movies.
No, which is very comprehensive, a great
splendid book.
Mm-hmm.
But it does come at the this type of movie from a very unusual angle, and I was I was fearful for a moment that it was going to turn out to be a crackpot theory, but it looks like it's holding water.
And
that
theory,
is to say
yeah.
that the Beach Party pictures of the 60s owed their influences not only to immediate precursors like Gidget or Where the Boys Are, but to the immense volume of tropical wild women movies that had been coming out of the off-Hollywood and Hollywood studios since the 20s.
And the fact that all of the servicemen, all the people that came out of the middle of the country and went over to places like Guam and other places in the South Seas, that became part of it as well when their minds sort of expanded and they saw this sort of mm-hmm. thing going on. And we're also coming at it as beach party films as fantasies.
Fantasies as opposed to documentary accounts of anthropological bias.
Right.
Yeah. and of course, all the cinema is anthropology in that
right.
sense, but that's probably over-intellectualizing things.
Well, and who cares? You know, I mean, it just, you know, get it and run with it, right? I mean,
but the fascination with tropical climates, semi-tropical climates, palm trees, pineapples, beaches. That's ancient. That goes all the way back to Paul Gauguin
yes.
and to Herman Melville,
mm-hmm.
and of course the funny thing that stands out for me is the obvious but I think underexplored cultural connection between Aquanetta, the exotic star of the 40s. And the very sound-alike personality of Annette Funicello.
Yes. And I think you've really come up with some fascinating parallels there that I didn't know about. We will say we don't want to give it all away, but there's some fascinating parallels between those two. And I've been researching mm-hmm. Aquanette, and I'm doing a little sidebar just on her when she first came out and her alleged feud with Maria Montez and some of the things mm-hmm. that went on, who was John Hall's big co-star, of course,
right.
to bring it back to Horror Party Beach. But I think there'll be some surprising things in it. And we had a little preview of it in Forgotten Horrors 9, a little preview of kind of the approach that we're taking. And mm-hmm. I just really like the way that it's coming out. And thanks to you and some of the things that we've explored that I don't know have ever been explored before. And they may be little intellectual conceits, but I think that we certainly present enough evidence to support them.
Well, yeah. And then, of course, the whole point of writing this sort of thing for a living is not only to do it for a living, but also for the privilege of inflicting one's crackpot opinions on as many people as you can.
Which is basically the reason for this podcast as well. And also to promote our own products, which why don't you talk about? I've noticed that Forgotten Horrors sales have been pretty robust on Amazon just recently.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. I don't know what it comes and goes, but of course the Forgotten Horrors books have been in continuous print since 1979.
Oh, that's right. That's when the first one came, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at the 40th anniversary of that title next year, and we'll have some new books in connection with that.
Mm-hmm.
The one I've just finished proofreading and getting ready to go to press with is a second volume of the comics anthology called Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
Yes.
And, of course, you're all over that one, too.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I believe a Slide Center slide maybe
that's right.
An appearance there.
Yeah, the satanic baseball game.
Mm-hmm. And yes, that's exactly right. Two of my favorite topics. And when will that be out?
Probably within the week if things
are going.
If things are going to suit me, we'll see where that goes.
Okay. And who else is in that volume, Michael?
Oh, well, of course, Rand Holmes, the artist, the underground artist on your story. Good old Jack Jackson from where else, Texas, with some of his early underground work that also fits into the Texas and horror connection. And, a lot of the great old-timers, some Robert Hayward Webb from the 50s, restored with the Texas angle intact. And a beauty of a piece from Bob Powell, one of the great Golden Age comics artists.
Absolutely. You know, Jim Vance and I, matter of fact, about the last thing that Jim did, he and I did introductions to the Kitchen Sink Dark Horse Bob Powell collections of Cave Girl and Jet Powers.
Right.
A wonderful artist.
So it's... It's all coming together, and so are many other things. And, gosh, how do we get so fortunate as to be able to work on all these fun projects?
I don't know, but it's a great blessing, and we appreciate it. And it's a great blessing every time someone out there buys one of those books, too. It's a wonderful blessing for us. And speaking of blessings, we want to say thank you to the man who wrote in as B-E-R-B-U-B. So I guess B Beerbub, Burbub. He wrote a very nice, and where was that on again, Joey?
It was on iTunes.
Wrote on iTunes. Very nice, very complimentary things about this podcast, and we really do appreciate that. And he also wrote me about Terror at Ten Killer. You know, we talked about Terror at Ten Killer some time back. He wrote us about Terror at Ten Killer. And said that when he was in high school, that he really lusted after Stacy Logan, who was the female lead, you'll recall, in Terror at Ten Killer. And if I remember right, either a Miss Oklahoma or a Miss Oklahoma finalist back in the day. And so it's always nice to hear from people like that.
Yeah, give it a somewhere between a thumbs up and a thumbs down.
That's right. Hopefully all the way to thumbs up, but, you know, however that works. Now, Joey has also said that we need to kind of let people know what we're going to be doing the next time around. We have been talking about doing one of your favorite Jungle Jim pictures next time, right?
Oh, yes.
Is that, what is that Jungle Jim and what was the name of it? Jungle Jim and...
You're talking about Killer Ape.
Or Forgotten Something. Now, see, I forgot it. It's not, I've forgotten it completely. Jungle Jim Envy Something.
Oh, Forbidden Land.
That's right, not Forgotten.
Yes,
Land. Forbidden
Land. We talked about that and Killer Ape, both
Killer
of which
Ape.
Are two of the more striking entries in that series, and both of which feature impossible monsters.
Right. And so we may be doing that next time, or we have a line on a talk about DIY. This is a do-it-yourself project that makes the John Hall thing look like doing Citizen Kane by yourself. Our friend Craig Lamb has re-edited a bunch of public domain footage into a Dracula sequel from the 1930s. And so we're probably going to be looking at that as well in our next podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We may look at both of those films. We may look at one. We're not sure. But those are a couple of things that are coming up here. Joey, is there anything that we're leaving out?
I don't think so.
Joey doesn't think there's anything we're leaving out, and that's good enough for me, Michael. So I will be talking to you soon. And again, we want to say thank you to the folks who listen, to the folks that buy our books, whether you're buying them in the hard copies or whether you're getting them in what's the way that they do it?
The Kindle
and all that kind of stuff. Yes, I don't sound too much like a Luddite, do I?
Well,
and, you know,
I can't understand the interest in reading a book on a computer screen, but no accounting for taste.
If you read one of our books, then read on. It's fine with us, however you want to do it. Michael, we'll check with you next time around, next meeting, and it should be coming up soon.
Outstanding.
Kiss, baby, kiss just one more time. Put your lips so close to mine. Dance, baby, dance to the surfer dance. Woo, you're moving just fine. Keep on pushing that line. Surfing, baby, of mine. Surfing, baby, of mine. Woo! Surfing, baby, of mine. Surfing, baby, of mine. Woo! Surfing.